Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 270. It's Sunday, August 18th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, big show today. Let's get to it with a great local story. This from the city of Toledo. They're issuing their draft comprehensive five-year plan on community violence prevention, and you can read the full document or provide feedback on the city website. The plan is called Peace in Motion, Toledo's Path to Community Safety. You can find the document and where to provide feedback by just searching for Peace in Motion, Toledo. The Community Action Table has worked for a year to develop recommendations that will guide the city's decision-making for the next 5 years. The Community Action Table is seeking feedback on the draft plan until September 13th. There is an overview survey to provide comment on the plan as a whole. You can also find five additional surveys that dive into each of the pillars and recommendations in the plan. And the five areas are reducing gun violence, changing attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors, neighborhood change, addressing social determinants, and ecosystem and societal changes. And they have recommendations around five pillars that I'll summarize for you, and these are the five areas that you can provide specific comments on if you care to. First up, enhancing the community violence intervention and prevention ecosystem. To implement and share evidence-based practices through Toledo's Community Violence Intervention Program ecosystem, so that the work being done to reduce gun violence aligns with best practices, to create a broad coalition of stakeholders that are committed to this work. And second, improving coordination and shared accountability. To ensure that the Community Violence Intervention Program work happening is at all levels, from grassroots to executive, and is empowered to contribute their expertise towards a community-wide effort that seeks to fill gaps, avoid duplicated services, and eliminate silos within the Community Violence Intervention Program ecosystem. Third, fostering hope and healing. To provide trauma-informed, healing-centered support to individuals and communities who have experienced gun violence, and create services and systems that address common challenges faced by those who are most impacted. Fourth, accessing opportunities. To ensure that risk factors for experiencing gun violence are replaced with opportunities and other protective factors, which will be designed specifically to meet the needs of those at highest risk of experiencing gun violence. So this is one that gets at social determinants, where they're dealing with job, income programs, and housing, for instance. And fifth, last but not least, building engaged neighborhoods and networks to empower all levels of the socio-ecological model with tools, resources, and opportunities for meaningful engagement in the work being done to reduce gun violence in Toledo. Key focuses include addressing the intersection of the built environment and violence and the role of that network, and the role that networks, whether online, social, or otherwise, play in increasing risk or offering protection against violence. So I'm glad to see that this was only a short few years ago when this initiative was launched and City Council declared gun violence a public health crisis in Toledo, a public health crisis. And I'm glad to see that they're addressing social determinants. I would say, you know, this reminds me, over 30 years ago, I was having lunch at the American Public Health Association with the health commissioner of Toledo at that time, when it was just a city, not the combined health department like it is today. And we had a discussion, an argument or debate, if you will, about whether gun violence should even be considered a public health issue. Of course, I was voting and advocating for it being considered a public health issue. He was arguing against it. Glad to see that we've moved to dealing with gun violence as a public health issue. Again, if you want to search for this document and give feedback, you can search for Toledo Peace in Motion. Now, the one comment I would give is that I think, you know, this is a city plan, and the city is really held captive with state and federal laws, or the lack thereof. They recognize in this plan that we are awash in guns, both legal and illegal. And in recent years, there's been a large increase in the number of guns stolen from cars and homes, and these are often ones that are used in criminal activity. Now, I've been a community planner for many years, and I find that the imprint from victims is so powerful that it makes it difficult to work upstream when you're working with those that are most concerned about gun violence. And a couple things that I notice that seem to be lacking is it doesn't seem to be much around the criminal justice system. For instance, domestic violence, I couldn't find a reference to that, which is a huge source of violence and gun deaths. And basically a racist criminal justice system. Well, and of course, that takes us back that the city may be held captive by state and federal laws, but also the county is the one that largely controls the criminal justice system locally here, so they're not necessarily dealing with it. So these are broader social determinants and a legislative or policy agenda that needs to happen at a larger level to really get at being awash in guns and other policies that can be done at larger levels beyond the city. But hey, great progress. Great to see it. If you want to give feedback, just search for Toledo Peace in Motion. Okay, well, next let's turn to an update on an Ohio story. This from the Environmental Health Network. Cleanup worker sickened by Ohio derailment is hidden in unreleased report. A report reveals that workers cleaning up the 2023 Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, suffered illness while working in contaminated creeks, but the findings were not disclosed to the public. Despite public concern, the report detailing these illnesses was not released, and the long-term health impacts remain unclear. Residents face a deadline to accept settlement money in exchange for waiving future legal claims. And a key quote from a East Palestine resident, "It's absolutely egregious, and that shouldn't happen. I think that any type of information like that, just like when the CDC workers came to the area and got sick, should be disclosed instead of diminished." Why this matters? The undisclosed illnesses raise concerns about transparency and the long-term health risks for East Palestine residents, with questions remaining about the adequacy of the cleanup efforts and monitoring. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to what is still the single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S. and the world, tobacco use. This from Gallup polls. Cigarette smoking rate in U.S. ties 80-year low. Cigarette smoking in the U.S. is at a low point, according to 8 decades of Gallup trends. Currently, 11% of U.S. adults say they have smoked cigarettes in the past week, matching the historical low measured in 2022 and nearly matched at 11% in 2023. When Gallup first asked about cigarette smoking in 1944, 41% of U.S. adults said they smoked. The current smoking rate is about half as large as it was a decade ago and one-third as large as it was in the late 80s. A major reason for the decline is that cigarette smoking has plummeted among young adults, who typically had been the most likely age group to smoke. Over the past 3 years, an average 6% of adults under age 30 say they have smoked cigarettes in the past week, compared to 35% of young adults in the 2001 through the 2003 surveys. Young adults are now less likely than other age groups to smoke cigarettes, as 13% of those between the ages of 30 and 49, 18% of those age 50 to 64, and only 9% of those age 65 and older say they smoke. Smoking continues to show a relationship to educational attainment, as 5% of college graduates and 15% of those without a college graduate say they've smoked cigarettes, based on the latest data. The rates for both groups are significantly lower than the past. Between 2001 and 2003, an average of 14% of college graduates and 30% of college non-graduates reported smoking, so that's been dropped more than half. Younger adults are more likely to smoke e-cigarettes. Vaping is less common than cigarette smoking, with 7% of U.S. adults saying they have smoked electronic cigarettes or vaped in the past week. The percentage of vapers has been steady between 6 and 8% of U.S. adults in Gallup polls since 2019. While young adults are now the age group least likely to smoke cigarettes, they are the group most likely to smoke e-cigarettes, according to the combined latest data, the most recent 3 years. 18% of adults age 18 to 29 vape, with the percentage declining among older groups down to 1% of those 65 and older. There are small educational differences in vaping, with 5% of college graduates versus 9% of college non-graduates using e-cigarettes. The generally low rates of cigarette and e-cigarette usage may stem from the perception that these products can cause harm. 79% of U.S. adults say cigarettes are very harmful to people who use them. 57% say the same about e-cigarettes. And I can't help but notice wondering what the 21% of U.S. adults that are not saying that cigarettes are very harmful. Yikes. Yet being the single largest preventable cause of death, given its prevalence and dangerousness, but hey, you can't reach everybody, I guess. But hey, if you or somebody you know who might be interested in quitting would like some help, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW and get resources and referrals to do just that. Okay, well, next up we have a related story is that as we see young people smoking cigarettes less, the vaping is increasing, and that has its own issues. This from Medical Express. Study finds vaping is linked to smoking cigarettes, using marijuana, and other drugs over time. U.S. teens and young adults who vape are much more likely to start smoking cigarettes or to begin using cannabis or other drugs, a University of Michigan study appearing in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence found. Findings for 12 to 17-year-olds over the study period, those who vaped only were 22 times likelier to start smoking, 7 times likelier to start using marijuana, and 3 times likelier to start using other drugs. For the 18 to 25-year-olds, those who vaped only were 11 times likelier to start smoking, 6 times likelier to start using marijuana, and twice as likely to start using other drugs. Some 39% of teens report vaping by 12th grade, and 14% of young adults report vaping in the past month. Other data indicate that people are starting cigarette smoking later in life. Historically, people started smoking before they hit their 20s, so finding that vaping puts young adults at greater risk for cigarette smoking is important when thinking about ways to prevent people with starting cigarette smoking. And of course, it's sort of kind of the whole gateway drug issue, and developing a nicotine addiction, of course, makes you much more likely to take up smoking tobacco, another source of nicotine, and also much, much more likely, in this case for younger people, 6 or 7 times likelier to start using marijuana, and 2 or 3 times more likely to use other drugs. And next up, in a story about America's shifting drug use, this from The Hill, more Americans see moderate drinking as unhealthy. The Gallup poll found that 45% of Americans believe drinking in moderation, that is 1 or 2 alcoholic beverages a day, is unhealthy. This percentage marks a new historic high and is 6 percentage points higher than when the poll was taken just last year. It is also 17 percentage points higher than when the poll was taken in 2018, according to Gallup. The poll also found that nearly 9 in 10 adults said drinking alcohol is very or somewhat harmful. Meanwhile, 8% said it is not too harmful, and 2% said it is not at all harmful. And of course, this is also tied with increasing marijuana use, which is seen as much less dangerous than drinking, is starting to increase. We're seeing it cut back on the amount of Americans drinking alcohol. In fact, I reported on in the last month or so that daily or near daily use of marijuana use is actually higher than daily or near daily use of alcohol. Okay, well, next up, let's do a nutritional story regarding two of the main things to be avoided in a healthy diet, which is saturated fats and added sugar. This from Medical Express. Identifying stealth sources of saturated fat and added sugar in the diet. A newly compiled list of foods and drinks commonly consumed in the United States hints at why many adults unknowingly overdo it on saturated fat and added sugar in their daily diet, a new study suggests. Beyond the biggest sources of each dietary category, cheese for saturated fat and soft drinks for added sugar, the study identifies a longer list of popular sources that helps explain why it's so hard to limit fat and sugar to the recommended 10% each of daily calories. With that overconsumption of unexpected sources like kitchen and ketchup, for example, comes a variety of ailments such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer. Overall, the top sources of saturated fat were cheese, pizza, ice cream, and eggs. Leading sources of added sugar were soft drinks, tea, that is sweetened teas, fruit drinks, and cakes and pies. Based on the USDA's What We Eat in America food list, other categories contributing to saturated fat intake include cold cuts, cream substitutes, fried potatoes, and whole milk. You notice that cream substitutes, of course, cream being a milk fat is one of the most highly saturated fats you can get, but the cream substitutes actually often use highly saturated plant oils. And of course, whole milk is another big source of dairy fat. Categories with added sugar include tomato-based condiments such as ketchup, cereal bars, energy drinks, and yeast breads. So, of course, yeast breads is most breads. There's actually quite a bit of sugar that's added to breads, and since bread is so commonly eaten, it adds up. Read those labels, my friends. Okay, well, let's switch gears and go to the next round, which could be more serious than the first round of MPOX. This from The Hill. What to know about MPOX global health emergency? The World Health Organization has declared the recent outbreaks of MPOX a global health emergency, warning that the new, more contagious strain of the virus could spread further internationally. But cases have been reported in several of its neighboring countries. In total, there have been more than 14,000 cases and over 500 deaths in Africa this year, exceeding the total number recorded last year, according to the WHO. And Sweden recorded the first case outside Africa of the dangerous MPOX variant clade 1. The MPOX outbreak that began in 2022 was caused by the less severe clade 2 virus. The global health emergency that the WHO declared last week is linked to the more severe clade 1 strain. In previous MPOX outbreaks, lesions appeared mostly on chest, hands, and feet. The new strain causes milder symptoms and is more likely to cause lesions on the genitals, which can make the disease much more difficult to detect, although actually it's more likely to kill you. How does it spread? MPOX typically requires person-to-person contact to spread, including through sexual contact, household contact, and contact within a healthcare setting without necessary protective equipment. Transmission can also occur during hugging, massaging, kissing, and during, quote, prolonged face-to-face interactions such as talking or breathing, according to the CDC. The virus can spread from someone with MPOX through direct contact with objects, fabrics, and surfaces if the object is not first disinfected after use. So how should individuals protect themselves against transmission? The CDC said people who have been vaccinated who have already had MPOX should be protected from the new strain emerging in African countries. The CDC said the best protection is for eligible people to get two doses of the vaccine. People eligible include those known or suspected exposure to someone with MPOX, those that are gay, bisexual, or other men who have had sex with a transgender, non-binary, or gender-diverse person who, in the last 6 months, has either a new diagnosis of a sexually transmitted disease or more than one sex partner, and those who, in the last 6 months, had sex at a commercial sex venue or sex in a geographic area where the MPOX transmission is occurring. People are also eligible to get the vaccine if they have a sex partner with the aforementioned risks or if they anticipate experiencing these risks. And of course, we don't have any cases identified in the U.S., but undoubtedly it is coming our way. You heard it here first, perhaps. Okay, next up in more infectious disease news, this from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Global cholera cases declined, but deaths on the rise. Compared to last year at this time, global cholera cases have declined 31%, but deaths are 34% higher, said the World Health Organization in its latest update, which includes data received in July. For July, 17 countries reported nearly 52,000 cases along with 223 deaths. Four WHO regions reported cases, with the Eastern Mediterranean region hit hardest, followed by the African region. Since late July, Nepal has reported new cholera clusters from several districts. The WHO said their response to the outbreaks is still hampered by a shortage of oral cholera vaccine, with 105 million doses requested by 18 countries since January of last year, nearly double the 55 million doses produced over that period. The WHO said the global risk is still very high and is considered a grade 3 emergency, which is the highest level of emergency. It added that transmission dynamics are increasingly complex, reflecting factors that cross country borders, such as population mobility, natural disasters, and climate change. Yes, another example where we need to get vaccines, produce more, and get them to those countries that are usually lower and middle income countries where outbreaks are occurring. Okay, well, next up, let's do a series of stories with a focus on women's health. This from The Hill: women's life expectancy in U.S. lowest among similar countries. Women in the U.S. can expect to live shorter lives than women in similarly wealthy nations, according to a brief from the Commonwealth Fund, a nonprofit research group focused on healthcare. The brief published used provisional data from the CDC to calculate the life expectancy for U.S. women in 2022 at birth, which, at 80, is the lowest female life expectancy among similarly high-income countries in areas such as Europe, Asia, and Oceania. The life expectancy for American women is 2 years shorter than that of the country with the next lowest female life expectancy, which is the United Kingdom, and 7 years shorter than that in Korea and Japan, which have the highest life expectancy for women. Life expectancy for Black, American Indian, and Alaskan Native women in the U.S. is lower compared to that of White, Asian, and Hispanic women, according to the provisional CDC data. Asian women in the U.S. have the highest life expectancy at about 86. Hispanic women can expect to live until age 83, and White women until age 80. Black women have a notably shorter life expectancy at about 76 and a half years, while Alaska Native American Indian have a life expectancy of about 71. So, huge differences between countries, but even more stark differences within the country for Blacks and Native Americans. And men, don't feel left out. Actually, men fare worse, and the disparities are even wider between comparable countries. Okay, well, next up, an often little talked about health issue, this from Medical Express. Study finds over half of iron deficiency cases in large health systems still unresolved at 3 years. Over half of people with iron deficiency were found to still have low iron levels 3 years after a diagnosis, and among patients whose conditions was effectively treated within that time frame, they faced longer than expected delays, pointing to substantial gaps in inappropriate recognition and efficient treatment of the condition, according to a study published in Blood Advances. Iron deficiency, or when the body's iron stores are too low, is common and may affect up to 40% of adolescents and young women. Iron is important in maintaining many body functions, including the production of hemoglobin, the molecule in the blood that carries oxygen, and is essential to maintaining healthy cells, skin, hair, and nails. If untreated, low iron stores can lead to mood changes, fatigue, hair loss, exercise intolerance, and eventually anemia. The condition is generally first treated with oral iron supplementation, and if low iron levels persist after a few months or the patient reports side effects, intravenous iron is started. According to a previous report, up to 70% of cases go undiagnosed in high-risk populations, such as those with bleeding disorders, issues with malabsorption, or women who menstruate. Iron deficiency is probably a bigger problem than we realize. I've seen a lot of cases where people don't have anemia, but they're walking around with very little or no iron in their body, and it can have a big impact on how people feel in their day-to-day life, said Jacob Kogan, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota and the study's lead author. Of note, younger patients, females, and Black individuals were most likely to remain iron deficient or experience longer lags in getting their iron stores back to a healthy level. Even among patients whose iron levels are restored to normal within the study duration, it took nearly 2 years, which researchers say is longer than expected and signals missed opportunities to more effectively manage the condition. The numbers are pretty striking and suggest a need to put systems in place to better identify patients and treat them more efficiently. And of course, unspoken in this article is that there's a myriad of social determinants that might lead to iron deficiency in the first place. And the healthcare system can only deal with that so much by pumping iron into people. But you do what you can.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, a story under the category of let's listen to those people that are most affected, including women. The Hill. Women across party lines oppose abortion laws being left to the states. Three-quarters of reproductive age women in the United States oppose letting states decide whether abortion is legal, including large majorities of Democrats and independents, according to a published survey. Opposition was highest among Democratic women at 88%, but the survey showed 53% of Republican and 73% of women who identified as independent also opposed the idea. More than two-thirds of those who live in states with abortion bans and gestational limits oppose leaving abortion decisions up to the states. The survey found that 1 in 7 women of reproductive age reporting having had abortion at some point in their life. The numbers were similar shares across women who identified as Republican at 12%, Democratic at 14%, and Independent at 15%. And of course, this includes the youngest women versus the older women within reproductive age. So of course, a lifetime experience is going to be somewhat higher than that. Okay, well, next up, let's look at abortion access in Ohio. This from the Ohio Capital Journal. Ohio sees spike in out-of-state abortions, but access to abortion care can be challenging. Even though abortion is legal in Ohio, accessing abortion care can be burdensome. Northwest and Southeast Ohio don't have any surgical abortion centers, meaning folks in those corners of the state have to travel far distances, sometimes even going out of state to receive abortion care. People go wherever they can get the quickest, and that might be in Columbus, it might be Cleveland, it might be Cincinnati, it might be Pennsylvania, said Erica Wilson-Domer, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio. But for those in neighboring states with near total bans, Ohio can be an abortion destination. We've seen about a 25% uptick in travelers. I know that Southwest Ohio has seen doubled their volume of travelers from out of state, if not more. There were 18,488 abortions performed in Ohio in 2022, a 27% increase compared to 2012, according to Abortion Forward. Of those abortions, nearly 1,300 were people who came to Ohio from a different state, according to Abortion Forward. Ohio has 6 surgical abortion clinics located in Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Bedford Heights, Cuyahoga Falls, and Dayton. Toledo's abortion clinic switched to just a medication abortion facility in 2019. Lack of clinics is a huge barrier. We've lost nearly half the abortion clinics in Ohio since 2011. All 88 counties have an abortion facility within 99 miles as of February 2022, according to an Ohio Policy Evaluation Network report. Choice on where to get care is very complex and very personal, so it's important to have a lot of options out there so that people can be making these choices for what's best for them. Abortion is legal in Ohio up until 22 weeks of pregnancy. Ohio voters passed a ballot measure last year that added protections to abortion care and reproductive rights to the state's constitution. Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia all have near total abortion bans, causing Ohio abortion clinics to be inundated with travelers. An estimated 1,260 Ohioans went to Michigan to receive an abortion in 2023. 920 went to Pennsylvania, 230 went to Illinois, and 100 went to Virginia, according to the Guttmacher Institute. There are a variety of barriers when it comes to abortion access, including some that are unique to Ohio. One is Ohio's transfer agreement. The state requires an abortion clinic to have a transfer agreement with a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic, so a patient can be transferred to medical care if medical care, quote, beyond the care that can be provided at an ambulatory surgical facility is needed. And of course, abortion, while a surgical procedure, is one of the safest surgical procedures there is. The transfer agreement is completely medically unnecessary because any patient that gets sent to an ER is going to be treated. State-funded hospitals can't sign a transfer agreement. In many places, the only non-state-funded hospitals are Catholic hospitals that obviously are not going to sign a transfer agreement with an abortion provider. So this makes it incredibly challenging to operate a surgical facility with all the trap laws that are sort of surrounding abortion care in Ohio. There is also a 24-hour waiting period in Ohio, meaning people have to go to an abortion clinic twice. The ACLU and Planned Parenthood Federation of America filed a lawsuit in the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas earlier this year that would undo Ohio's 24-hour waiting period. Transportation is also a big barrier for people. Cost is another hurdle. Depending on location and provider, a first trimester abortion can cost around $800 or less, but the cost of second trimester abortion can range from $715 to $2,000, according to Planned Parenthood. There can be additional costs that accompany getting an abortion, including childcare, lodging, travel, and food. All of those costs just increase anytime someone has to leave, and it can really put abortion care out of reach for too many people, said Kristen Hady, a volunteer with the Aggie Fund, a Northwest Ohio abortion fund. It's a huge barrier for people to have to travel out of the places that they live for their health care. Toledo used to have two full-service abortion clinics, Center for Choice and Capital Care Network, but the Center for Choice closed in 2013 when it was unable to get a transfer agreement. Coincidentally, the number of out-of-state residents getting abortions in Michigan jumped from 531 in 2012 to 906 in 2013 and over 1,300 in 2014, according to data from Abortion Forward. Michigan's data doesn't track which state patients come from. Capital Care changed ownership in 2019 and switched to a medication abortion-only facility. Medication abortions accounted for 63% of all abortions in the formal healthcare system in 2023 nationwide, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Today, the clinic is called Toledo Women's Center, and their sister clinic is Northeast Ohio Women's Center, meaning women in the Toledo area typically either go there or Michigan. Michigan performed 1,162 abortions to out-of-state residents in 2018, 1,437 in 2019, 1,621 in 2020. There were 2,761 out-of-state abortions in Michigan in 2022. Now that abortion is protected in Ohio's Constitution, there are hopes abortion access will expand. So people are bouncing around all over, depending what part of the state you're in and whether you're in a state that abortion is still severely restricted or legal, like in Ohio, up to 22 weeks. What a mess. Let's get national protection for abortion rights. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal promise to you is, if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should that turn out to not be true, I would gladly refund triple your money back. Okay, well, let's turn to one more story where women are affected disproportionately. This from Medical Express. Chemicals in makeup and sunscreen may raise odds for dangerous pregnancy complications. Phenols and parabens in these products increase a pregnant woman's risk of high blood pressure by 57%, particularly late in pregnancy at 24 to 28 weeks of gestation, researchers reported in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. We found chemicals in everyday soaps, lotions, makeup, sunscreen, and other personal care products and consumer products that increase the risk of hypertension among a study group of pregnant women in Puerto Rico, said study lead researcher Julia Varshavsky. Phenols and parabens are used as UV filters in sunscreens and to prevent the growth of harmful mold and bacteria in makeup and cosmetics, researchers said. Parabens alone are used in about 80% of personal care products. Phenols and parabens linked to hypertension in pregnancy is troubling. High blood pressure during pregnancy reduces blood flow to the placenta, so the fetus might wind up starved for oxygen and nutrients. As a result, the fetus might suffer from restricted growth, low birth weight, and premature birth. It's dangerous for expecting moms as well, increasing their risk of complications like preeclampsia and stroke. Both mother and child also have an increased likelihood that they will suffer from high blood pressure, diabetes, and heart disease long after pregnancy. Looking at chemicals in personal care products is really important for pregnant individuals in particular because women on average use at least 12 personal care products a day, Farshovsky noted. And the fact that these can increase may increase risk of hypertension during pregnancy is important because that sets the stage for lifelong health in both the mother and the child. There are several reasons why the chemicals might be increasing blood pressure in pregnant women. Phenols and parabens are known to increase inflammation and oxidative stress in humans, which has been linked to high blood pressure. The chemicals are also known to disrupt hormones in humans, and these hormones also play a role in regulating blood pressure. Varshavsky's advice? Women who are pregnant, or even when they're not, may want to consider cutting back on certain products. The approach I take in my personal life is to try to mitigate exposure when I can. So, when I was pregnant, I did try to limit the amount of products I use more so than I would otherwise, she said. I definitely would suggest to try to focus on fragrance-free products and products that have been identified or labeled as paraben-free, for example, which is something that is occurring. Varshavsky also noted that the good thing about phenols and parabens are that these chemicals have short biological half-lives, which basically means that we metabolize them relatively quickly. So, if we reduce our exposure, the levels in our body goes down pretty quickly. Nevertheless, this is not a problem that we can necessarily shop our way out of. Our findings show that the FDA and the EPA need to be doing a better job of protecting public health from harmful chemical exposures, especially during pregnancy. Scientists, advocates, and regulators need to work together to increase product labeling and industry responsibility to ensure chemicals are proven to be safe before they're put into commerce. We also need industry innovation to identify safer alternatives and upstream solutions to this problem. Okay, let's switch gears and next up do a story on another vulnerable population, this from the Environmental Health Network. Wildfires expose farm workers to dangerous smoke as climate change intensifies. A new study reveals that climate change-driven wildfires are subjecting farm workers to hazardous air pollution, with many continuing to work in unsafe conditions out of economic necessity. Farm workers in Sonoma County, California, worked through dangerous wildfire conditions in 2020, inhaling toxic smoke with little protection. Researchers found that air quality monitors and emergency protocols failed to safeguard workers during the fires. Many farm workers, especially those lacking legal status, face increased health risks without adequate protections or health coverage. In a key quote from a farm worker, "We always expose ourselves to danger out of necessity, whether by fire or disaster, when the weather changes, when it's hot or cold." Why does this matter? As wildfires worsen with climate change, farm workers, essential to the food supply, are increasingly vulnerable to health risks from toxic smoke exposure. Highlighting the need for better protections is a matter of both food security and climate justice. So may the foods that we eat not cause harm to others. And next up, one short healthcare story, this from Modern Healthcare. Employer health plan costs expected to rise 9% in 2025. Employer-sponsored health plan costs are expected to rise 9% in 2025, totaling more than $16,000 per employee before cost-saving measures, according to professional services and consulting company Aon. Aon predicts that demand for prescription drugs such as glucagon-like peptide 1 agonists and growth in medical claims for high-cost treatments such as gene and cell therapies are among the main drivers of rising costs for employers. So these wonder drugs for weight loss are very powerful, but they're also very expensive, and at the current pricing are not really cost effective. And most of the new treatments that are being developed, while they may be effective, are very high cost and also are of dubious cost effectiveness. Of course, that is often linked to huge profitability. The Wegovy and such weight loss drugs, while they retail for well over $1,000 a month, cost about $5 a month to make. Okay, well, next up, a Short story here on industry influence. This from the Environmental Health Network. World Health Organization to withdraw PFAS water guidelines after accusations of corruption. The World Health Organization plans to retract its proposed drinking water guidelines for PFAS chemicals following claims of industry influence and weak protection of public health. In short, WHO's draft guidelines for PFAS chemicals were criticized for allowing levels far above U.S. and EU limits. Allegations surfaced that industry-linked researchers influenced the guidelines to undermine stricter regulations. WHO is now forming a new panel with fewer industry ties to reassess the guidelines. This is unprecedented, but the WHO got unprecedented criticism. Why all this matters? PFAS chemicals are linked to severe health issues, including cancer and liver disease. Weak guidelines could leave populations exposed to dangerous levels of these forever chemicals in drinking water. And of course, drinking water is just one of the many exposures to PFAS chemicals. Okay, and next up, last but not least, some good news on the petrochemical pollution front. This from the Environmental Health Network. U.S. shifts to support global plastic production cuts. In a significant policy shift, the United States is now backing a global treaty to reduce plastic production, putting it at odds with major plastic producers like Saudi Arabia and China. According to a source close to negotiators, the U.S. will support a global treaty to reduce the production of new plastic, a change from its previous stance. This move aligns the U.S. with countries like the EU and Canada, which advocate for caps on plastic production and eliminating harmful chemicals. The U.S. will also support creation of a list of harmful chemicals for phase-out. The policy shift comes just before crucial treaty negotiations in South Korea and has received mixed reactions from industry and environmental groups. The significant change of heart by the U.S. State Department to support a global target that will reduce plastic production and to identify a list of hazardous chemicals to be eliminated from plastics is affirmation of hard work by an assemblage of organizations working to ensure that treaty negotiations fully incorporate concerns about the human health effects of chemicals in plastics. It was already clear that the current level of plastic production was unsustainable and that current business-as-usual projections by industry were going to make things much worse. If the State Department sticks to this commitment, we will all benefit. And why all this matters? By backing the treaty, the U.S. is acknowledging that our addiction to plastics is not just an eyesore, but a real threat to our health and the environment. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 32 bonus articles. Okay, let's get to it. Let's start up with the wild, woolly world of public policy, regulations, and enforcement. First up, decrepit pipes put Jackson, Mississippi on the edge of catastrophe. State regulators didn't act. This is straight up racism and even required federal involvement gets state regulators to actually act. Bonus article two, it isn't just in Mississippi. It's even one of our most liberal and wealthy states, California. California cuts back on safety enforcement as farm workers toil in extreme heat. So they pass some more cutting edge heat protections, but then don't enforce it. Bonus article three, when is recyclable not really recyclable? When the plastic industry gets to define what the word means. Yep, speaks for itself. Bonus article four, how a legal loophole allows unsafe or untested ingredients in U.S. foods. So there's the GRAS list, the generally recognized as safe list that was started many decades ago. And food companies can decide for themselves if an ingredient is close enough to one of those ingredients, they don't even have to notify, send a letter or anything to the FDA. They just add it. Bonus article five, Department of Health and Human Services says it's working to stop the climate crisis. But it's really just climate washing, focusing on climate mitigation rather than emissions reductions. So they have goals about reducing emissions in healthcare, but basically what they're actually doing is just preparing for the worst of climate change. It is not inevitable unless we allow it to be. Bonus article six, the FDA should withdraw approval of more than 400 medicines fraudulently tested. So this was an Indian company that tested medicines and fraudulently submitted data to the U.S. FDA. The EU has already, gotten rid of these 400 medicines until they get appropriate, safety testing. But the U.S. has not done that. Bonus Article 7. The FDA calls them recalls, yet the targeted medical devices often remain in use. So it's much more complicated. And sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes they do some little fixes. Sometimes there's many iterations. So very slow to act. Bonus Article 8. Journal conflict of interest disclosure policies are all over the map and rely on the honor system. So even in the field of science, journals are not doing, do not have strong policies for conflict of interest disclosures and rely almost exclusively on the honor system. Bonus Article 9. Newly transparent pricing data fuel employer lawsuits against Aetna. So this is some good news, is that there were federal regulations that required what prices health insurance companies were and hospitals and healthcare providers were paying, and the people that have Aetna can have actually looked at this and are contending that Aetna is not actually adequately even being a fiduciary responsible agent. For providing healthcare at a reasonable cost, paying way more than many other health insurance companies. A lot of kickbacks involved there. Bonus Article 10. Six Ontario First Nations challenge mining law in court. So in Canada, there's a lot of mining, and Indigenous peoples, First Nations, are having to challenge this because they're really getting run over roughshod. And another mining story, bonus Article 11, mining threatens Arizona's scarce water supply. So in Arizona, there's no regulation of water use in mining operations. And mining is increasing as we're seeing more resource extraction, perhaps ironically to deal with, you know, development of EVs and sustainable energy sources. So, and of course, Arizona has water supply issues. Bonus Article 12. Without federal protections to lower prescription drug costs, states head to the courthouse. So, suing can sometimes be necessary, but a better solution would be broad, particularly federal protections, in this case for prescription drug costs. Most pharmaceutical companies just consider these lawsuits a cost of doing business, and much more fear having actual regulations with teeth that are enforced. Bonus Article 13. FDA seeks fresh voluntary curbs on sodium levels in packaged and processed foods after some success in earlier efforts. So this is a better news story. They've made some progress in working with industry to reduce salt or sodium levels in packaged and processed foods, and they have made progress. The one area they haven't made progress has been in sodium use in restaurants. It's likely those levels are going up as they are going down. Bonus Article 14. Inside conservative activist Leonard Leo's long campaign to gut Planned Parenthood. So if you're a billionaire, and this is the same billionaire that's corrupted the Supreme Court, you get to do pretty much whatever you want to distort our democracy and the will of the people. Bonus Article 15. Medicare data estimates Lyme disease rates 7 times higher than surveillance shows. So this is just an example of how public health is really underfunded, and there's actually not very good surveillance going on. So when they looked at this Medicare data where there's actual diagnosis of Lyme disease, it showed rates 7 times higher than our surveillance system for Lyme disease. So not picking up the vast majority of those cases through the surveillance system. Of course, if we were like the UK and we had a National Health Service, you would have all that data in one place, and that would be your surveillance system. I wish. Bonus Article 16, very elegant, interesting, fascinating story. Deer hunting season raises firearm violence in U.S. rural counties during first 2 weeks after opening of deer hunting season. This is fascinating, and basically what it shows is when you got people running around with a lot of guns, even if you're just going hunting, it actually ticks up, and this was like a 40% increase in those 2 weeks after opening. Fascinating study. Another one on gun violence, bonus Article 17. Kids who survive Super Bowl shooting are scared and suffering panic attacks and sleep problems. Just the traumatic effects of gun violence in our country. Bonus Article 18. 1 in 4 brain injury patients who appear unresponsive respond covertly. So this means their body motor responses do not work, but cognitively they can actually respond to commands that can be picked up like on EKGs and such. or ECGs, whatever the electroencephalogram, EEGs. Bonus article 19. Sudden cardiac arrest often causes sudden death. Scientists search for ways to better predict risk. So this is one of the scary things about heart disease, as often tens of thousands and tens of thousands of times each year, people's first sign of heart disease is dying of a massive heart attack. So you don't get to wait to deal with it later. Sometimes the first sign is death. And of course, if you want to go upstream and actually deal with heart disease, bonus article 20, getting fats from plants versus animals boosts your lifespan. This is more so with heart disease, but also affects overall lifespan, of course, cancer and such like that as well. This is sometimes, there's been so much disinformation about saturated fats, but trust me, as a public health nutritionist, and this study was a massive study, hundreds of thousands of people over like 20, I think this was like 24 years, huge study showing that getting fats from plant sources is much better for your longevity. Bonus article 21, bird flu cases now detected in domestic cats in Colorado. And interesting, when they say domestic, they actually, there were a couple cases in cats that are whatever, not homebound, but house cats that don't leave the house, or at least the owners don't know they leave the house. And what they're afraid of is that, not the fraidy cats, but the researchers, is that they're getting mice that are infected with bird flu, which of course has happened before too, and could be a reservoir for so-called bird flu. The bird flu, of course, is now in like 50 animal species and is spreading. Bonus article 22, inactive bird flu virus found in 17% of U.S. dairy foods. So this is, if you're a really astute listener, there was a report on this. They did an earlier study where it was just a little bit higher than that, but these studies are different. They did it in more states and they did more foods, so they're not necessarily comparable. But the point being that, in this study, for instance, over 1 in 6 of dairy foods actually have bird flu inactivated, because that's part of the process when you either process like you're making cheese or you're pasteurizing milk. Okay, we're going to keep looking at bird flu. Bonus article 23, though. 25 common lab tests not useful in diagnosing long COVID. This is just fascinating because, you know, things with inflammation or liver function, all these kind of things, none of this was actually helpful in getting a diagnosis for long COVID. Just how complex and elusive long COVID is for how serious it is. Bonus article 24, the U.S. is experiencing its largest summer COVID wave in at least 2 years. Interesting title, at least 2 years. How come we don't know if it's 3 years? Is because we're not doing very good surveillance like we were 2 or 3 years ago. So we may be, it may be the largest COVID wave in 3 years, but we don't know. In like the first rule in public health gaslighting is, if you do not measure it, it doesn't exist. Bonus article 25. First case of polio confirmed in a 10-month-old child in Gaza. So Gaza is hopefully going to get like 1.6 million vaccinations doses so that they can stop this polio outbreak. But they've had the first case. And of course, once you start getting cases, you know that there's a lot more cases out there. So hopefully they can have a ceasefire and get their primary care health system up enough to do these immunizations, for that and 1,000 other reasons. Bonus article 26, shingles tied to 20% higher risk of cognitive decline. So just another reason to get your shingles vaccine. Shingles is bad enough, and it'd be nice to kind of avoid that. But one of the bonuses you may get is, if you avoid shingles, you may lower your risk for cognitive decline. But if you want to really get to Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline, this next article is for you. Bonus article 27, Alzheimer's risk rose up to 42% with untreated high blood pressure. So blood pressure is a well-established risk factor for Alzheimer's and is one of the more profound factors, particularly considering how common high blood pressure is and how poorly even people with identified high blood pressure actually have it under control. Bonus article 28, national study shows varying ability across U.S. to get Alzheimer's or other dementia diagnosis. So this is like a twofold difference, and this is controlling for risk factors for Alzheimer's. So people are not getting the same health care. It varies a lot. perhaps not a surprise in the U.S. Bonus Article 29, prior authorization denials are on the rise in Medicare Advantage, which should be renamed Medicare Disadvantage. Bonus Article 30, intervention for cleaning shared healthcare equipment can significantly reduce healthcare-associated infections. So, healthcare-associated infections kill a lot of people through sepsis, blood infections, and also it leads to the development of antimicrobial-resistant bacteria, which is a growing problem. So this is basically just doing more of a deep cleaning, which means there's a lot of room to do more cleaning in hospitals to reduce these healthcare-associated infections. And this doesn't take high levels of education. In fact, unfortunately, sometimes those cleaning duties are like nurses and such, where you can just get other people who are cleaning to room to do more extensive cleaning of common surfaces, that type of thing. Bonus Article 31, non-deceptive or open placebos can reduce stress, anxiety, and depression. So this is the importance of accents the importance of placebos when you're testing any type of intervention, because if you know that you're getting a placebo, it still actually works, which is an astounding thing. And part of that is because a placebo is not nothing. You're actually getting attention, and you're considered valued by participating in a study. Those type of things are actually important. We like to have human connections, and that alone can reduce stress, anxiety, and depression. Fascinating. And last but not least, to tie up for the very first story that I did on gun violence in one area that the city plan didn't really deal with was incarceration. Bonus Article 32 is mass incarceration and health inequities. So if you want a good overview of that, read that article. You can read these and all the other articles I've reported on in this show and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.